produced by Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, and Wayne Hall. This is Yes Music Podcast, episode 406. What did they do next? Part 7A. Rick Wakeman, again.
This is Bill Bruford, the ever-enthusiastic young drummer from the group Yes, and you're listening to the Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 406 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine, and co-host Mark Anthony Kay will be along a little bit later on. Please do get involved yourself with the podcast via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. This week, Mark and I start our look at what Rick Wakeman did after leaving Yes for the second time, after the Paris sessions of 1979. That means we need to listen to his double solo album, Rhapsodies. Stay tuned for Mark's slightly strong feelings about this record a little bit later on. Before that, we have no fewer than three press releases, which show once again that it's a fantastic time to be a Yes fan. Firstly, there's news, which you may have picked up already, about Jeff Downes' Downes Braid Association. And here it is. DBA announce additional show at Trading Boundaries and reveal full band lineup. Live in England box set out 29th of November. Downes Braid Association recently announced the release of Live in England, a 2CD/DVD box set, on the 29th of November 2019 via Cherry Red Records. A double vinyl issue will be released on 14th of February. The album features stunning artwork by legendary Roger Dean. To coincide with the vinyl release of Live in England, DBA will be on stage once again at Trading Boundaries on the 14th of February. As the show is close to selling out, the band has added a second show on the 15th of February. These intimate gigs are totally unique. Joining Jeff Downes and Chris Braid this time round will be guitarist Dave Bainbridge, Iona Life Signs, together with bass player Andy Hodge and David Longdon, Big Big Train. And the show will again be narrated by Barney Ashton Bullock. For full information and to book tickets, please visit tradingboundariesmusic.com. Live in England, the fourth album released by the duo Jeff Downes and Chris Braid, is their first live album recorded at their first ever concert at Trading Boundaries, East Sussex, on 28th of September 2018. Whilst DBA was conceived as a studio project, the concert was a great success and features material from DBA albums Suburban Ghosts and Skyscraper Souls, together with tracks from Jeff Downes' time with Buggles and Asia. Check out the show notes for this week's episode for the full track listing of that. Next up, our great friend and YMP patron Dave Watkinson has launched his John Anderson book, which is something we've been looking forward to for a long time. Here's the press release from Yes author and another YMP patron, Stephen Lamb's company, Sonic Bond Publishing. John Anderson and the Warriors, The Road to Yes by Dave Watkinson. A new biography of John Anderson, which covers his early life and his time in the Warriors, up to the formation of Yes and the release of the band's first album in 1969. To be published on December the 13th via Summer Ends Festival promoter Stephen Lamb's Sonic Bond Publishing Company, and will be made available exclusively via Burning Shed. Author David Watkinson takes us on a journey from the Lancashire beat music scene of the early 1960s to the vibrancy of London later in the decade. In the short time that the Warriors existed, from 1963 to 1967, they released a single, appeared on TV and in a movie, and spent a year following in the Beatles' footsteps as a working group in Germany. As well as providing a complete history of the Warriors, this book also follows John's subsequent career in London via appearances with Gunn and his brief solo career as Hans Christian. He finally met Chris Squire and found a home in Mabel Greer's toy shop, as that group gradually morphed into Yes during the summer of 1968. The book includes new interviews with John and many members of the Warriors, who were in the band through its various lineup changes, most for the very first time. It also features a newly researched family tree, never seen before photographs, both of the Warriors and the first lineup of Yes, plus many items of memorabilia and an exclusive look into the band's diaries. It closes with a comprehensive discography and a collectibles section. Initially, the book will only be available in a limited hardback edition of 250, priced £25. All copies will be numbered and signed by the author, Dave Watkinson, and will be made exclusively available via Burning Shed. 224 pages, and it features over 200 photographs, most unseen for over 50 years. A paperback edition will be published in Europe on March 27th, 2020, and June 26th in the USA. This later edition will be available via all normal bookselling channels. So that's fantastic stuff. We will be speaking to Dave about this next week on the show. But in the meantime, you'd better be quick and snap up one of the hardback copies. I've seen parts of this book as it's been developed, and there's absolutely no doubt that it's going to be a brilliant read for all Yes fans. Finally, in the press releases, we should all support yet another YMP patron, Lobate Scarp, as they run a Kickstarter for their new album. Here's the main blurb. Come with us on this journey as we create our second full-length album. You have it all. We are a progressive space opera rock band based in Los Angeles. Our influences range from classic prog rock of the 70s, such as Genesis and Yes, to 80s pop, such as Simple Minds and Tears for Fears, as well as strong ties to musical theatre. I interviewed Adam Sears from Lobate Scarp way back in episode 70 of the show, which was in February 2013. I've always really liked their debut album Time and Space, and this time round they have some pretty spectacular special guests who you might recognise. As they put it, Billy Sherwood and John Davison, both from legendary band Yes, and Ryo Okamoto from Spock's Beard. However, as this is a Kickstarter project, it won't happen at all unless we all support it. If you do decide to pledge, you can get hold of some really nice merchandise in return, but it's much more important to help this potentially great progressive album come to fruition. Do get involved by visiting lsalbum2.com. It's worth it just to see the brilliant video, which I've also embedded into the show notes for this week. Well, after all that goodness, here's just a very brief tour around the social webs for this week. On the YMP Facebook page, Mark posted a reminder that it's Fragile's birthday this week, and Daniel Crone reviews Talk, which is possibly, he says, his favourite Yes album. That's a good pick, if you ask me. The mighty Miguel Falcao is pictured with his restored double bass, and the person who restored it. It was his grandfather's instrument, so even more special. And Mark added Rick Wakeman's Criminal Record, which I think he likes rather more than the one we're talking about today. Jeff Downs posted a little self-shot video about the new live DBA album, and in the visitor post, the ever-reliable Jeffrey Mason kept us entertained with reviews of From a Page and the Steve Howe Trio album, interviews with Taylor Hawkins of the Foo Fighters, that's the guy who connected John Davison with Chris Squire, Billy Sherwood and Steve Howe, a YouTube video of Alan White's Spring Song of Innocence, and a clip of the America promo from 1972 with enhanced sound. Jeffrey was joined by Paul Gosling, who posted his Tony K video interview from Yes 50, Tim Stannard, who added a John Anderson interview, and Doug Curran with his Lego Yes Band members from musicalbrick.com. Doug Curran is now, incidentally, the official YMP release police. Not really. So if you're unsure of a Yes record release date, he's your man, and Bill Hayes has his copy of From a Page. Brady Queen spotted the latest Rick Wakeman solo release, which is his forthcoming Christmas Portraits album, and Mike DeBell is running with the fox in Canada, as it's snowing a lot over there. Dem got in touch as well, and here's what he said. Hearing all of the Oliver-related stuff in the past couple of episodes got me looking into Oliver's website, and I found this particular webpage fascinating. oliverwakeman.co.uk/memories of Chris Squire blog. It's from 2015 and contains Oliver's memories of Chris and also of his spell in Yes, including thoughts at that time on some of the new music that's just been released. There are some great stories and insights again of that period. Well worth a read. Lots of stuff I hadn't heard before. One thing that has really struck me is what a nice guy Oliver is. What a shame he had to leave. Sounds almost like Yes didn't particularly want him to leave, but they somehow got nudged into making that decision. What a shame. Another great keyboard player that got away. Most recently like Igor and Tom Brislin, both of whom I really like. Oliver seems to combine that Wakeman style with a more modern and versatile approach. Best of both worlds. I'll have to look into some of his other stuff, as I really like what he's done on From a Page. So, many thanks, Dem. Owing to popular demand, well, Guy de Rome anyway, the YMP is now going to be available on Spotify, so do look out for that. As always, thank you so much to everyone who's been in touch in any way this week, including the show notes commenters, Joseph Cottrell, Doug Curran, H.B. Pedersen, Mike, and John Parry.
Olá, sou o Miguel Falcão, de Coimbra, Portugal. Estão a ouvir o Yes Music Podcast.
So this week it's the first part in our next part of what happened to the Yes Men who left and what did they do next after leaving the band. Now, the last one we did was John Anderson, and he left at the same time as Rick Wakeman. So it's on today to Rick Wakeman, i.e. Oliver's dad. And this album was actually written and created in Switzerland, I think. So that's, Oliver did mention that when his dad went to Switzerland and he hardly ever saw him at that stage in his life. However, what we're talking about is Rhapsodies. And this, I'm going to have to rely on you, obviously, but with your encyclopedic knowledge of Mr. Wakeman and Mark, that is. I haven't even introduced you. We're just getting straight on with it today. So something very, very odd looking to my eyes. This is a double album called mm-hmm. Rhapsodies. It's got 17 songs and it lasts for, let's have a look, 1 hour and 7 minutes. Okay. So is this a record? Let's, before we talk, you know, in depth about it, or at least what we think it's going to be like for me, and what you know it's like. Is it an album that you bought early on and have listened to lots of times?
Well, it wasn't one that I bought early on. I actually ended up getting it about, you know, after I started collecting his records, about halfway through my, you know, big collecting stage, right. I stumbled into Rhapsodies. And my first reaction when I saw it was great. This is fantastic. A double album. Mm. You know, lots of songs. I mean, so far at that point, I'd not been disappointed by really anything, as I had, you know, Arthur and Journey, Six Wives. I had No Earthly Connection. I had a lot of things because I was starting from the beginning, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then when I got to this, my head sort of sank because listening to this, let's put it this way. This album is way too long. They could have easily kept this a single album and it still would have been painful, in my opinion.
Oh, no. But
I've listened to this record maybe 3 times.
Right, right. Okay. Well, next week we're going to be listening to it in a bit more detail and then discussing it next week or a week after. I don't quite know when we'll come back to part two. But what I did was I had a look at, very briefly, the Wikipedia entry for this, because I've heard nothing of this album at all. Mm-hmm. And also I looked up the word Rhapsodies, because this is a little bit like using Madrigal on Tormato, or Evensong. Now, that was that ABWH Evensong?
That was Union.
Or is Union. Okay, so they take these words, which are pre-existing musical terms, and they use them in completely unrelated ways, certainly with Evensong and Madrigal. So I looked up Rhapsodies, and this is what I'm looking forward to. Okay, so a Rhapsody is officially an effusively enthusiastic or ecstatic expression of feeling. Okay, and the example they give is Rhapsodies of Praise. So that's the first meaning of it. Now, secondly, they go on to a musical meaning. A free instrumental composition in one extended movement, typically one that is emotional in character. And the example that they give is Liszt's Hungarian Rhapsodies. And then a third meaning is, in ancient Greece, an epic poem or part of a poem of a suitable length for recitation at one time. So, with your knowledge of the music, does that sound like it?
Well, I think the second one that you mentioned there is probably the closest that it is as far as the definition being, you know, this kind of uplifting, happy piece of music. To my ears, this music bothers me for one reason, because the sounds that he picked on his keyboards for this are bordering on disastrous for me. I don't like the sounds that he uses. And that's very rare for me to say that about Rick's recordings. I usually love the sounds that he picks, but you'll hear it yourself. But to me, the melodies that he plays on some of these songs remind me of carnival music.
Oh, right.
It really reminds me of, like, when I'm going to, like, you know, the Midway, you know, at the end of summer.
Yeah.
And you hear that kind of like kind of music going on, that really high paced or like annoying kind of music.
Yeah.
You'll hear it. Just remember that. And you'll hear it.
That doesn't sound like my favorite of Rick's work, that's for sure. But anyway, I haven't listened to it yet, so I'll I'll reserve judgment. However, we do have in John Kirkman's new version of his dialogue, interviews, we do have an interview with Rick Wakeman about the A&M period of his output. And as it happens, totally by accident, Rhapsodies was the last album that he made for A&M. So he talks to Rick about this. And what I'm going to do is just read out a little bit of that interview, because I think it kind of fills in some of the gaps for me in understanding of this album before I've even listened to it. So, Rick Wakeman says, the idea for a double album was Tony Visconti's. Now, he was producer, is that right, Tony Visconti?
Yes, he was.
A&M were insistent, because everyone was using producers at that time, that I get a producer. So I said, fine, as long as it's someone who understands me and understands music. So they were very happy I chose Tony Visconti. And of course, I had worked with him with David Bowie and the Straubs. He's a good musician and a really nice guy. So it's all sounding good at this stage. So we recorded in a mobile at my house in Switzerland, halfway up a mountain in the Alps, which was great fun. Although with Tony being American, he doesn't quite understand that when the snow came where I lived in the Alps, it really came. I told him that he really needed to get the mobile truck down the mountain before the snow came. Tony said he was sure it'd be all right, but I told him no. Anyway, the first night, the snow came, all 8 feet of it. So I was stuck there. Sounds a bit like you, Mark, in your situation. In the end, they had to airlift it down, and it cost a fortune. Typical Rick Wakeman story again, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But the album was great fun to do. There were some interesting sounds on our album, like the March of the Gladiators, and we'll come back to the track listing in a minute. I was always intrigued by the sounds I got on that one. There was a new digital sound around at the time, like what the Buggles were doing with Trevor Horn and Jeff Downes at exactly the same time. But it was also the end of what I would say was the analog era too. There were some great analog sounds too, but they didn't get used that much because of the arrival of digital. And of course, there was a rush to use the new technology. I loved some of these analog sounds, and a lot of them were used in this particular album. We also did some fun things, which I suppose were a bit self-indulgent, but I'm still glad I did them. Yes, I think we've got an idea of that already from you, Mark. Tony wanted to have all the different types of music I had been involved in over the years. So there we are, there's a clue. Mm-hmm. Sounds like he's just, you know, dipping back into his catalogue and doing all sorts of different things. One of the things that came up was traditional jazz, because one of the first things I did was a traditional jazz band called Brother Wakeman and the Clergyman. At the age of 12, because I loved Dixieland jazz. So Tony said, let's do a Dixieland track then. I said that we didn't have a Dixieland band, but he suggested I could do it all on the instruments I had. That sounds like a recipe for disaster to me, I have to say. Mm-hmm. Now, that would be fine now with all the digital sampling that we have these days, but back in 1978, when I recorded the album, it was not that easy. The track was called Half Holiday, and it was all done quite primitively on analog keyboards. I was really pleased with how it turned out because it really did sound very genuine. The other thing we wanted to do, or should I say Tony wanted to do, was Rhapsody in Blue. And again, with all the parts played on keyboards. Again, today, very easy to do with all the sampling technology, but back then, not so easy. It reminds us a bit of Cans and Brahms. That was all, you know, a classical piece done on keyboards by Mr. Wakeman. Again, there were lots of single notes and single line playing, which took a long time. We had a rhythm section of two guys from New Zealand who had worked with Tony a lot, and they were super players. I have to say that a lot of the tracks on the album, if I had been producing, would not have been done. Rhapsody in Blue, Half Holiday, and Woolly Willy Tango would not have been done. Having said that, I'm really glad I did do them, because sometimes it's really helpful when someone says, come on, do something a bit off the wall. It was an album that was liked much more in Europe than in the UK and America. By the way, if anyone looks at the cover and wonders, that picture was taken halfway up a mountain in my back garden. So, there we go. So, he's saying basically that had he had more of a say in it, he wouldn't have done some of those pieces. Which is absolutely fascinating. Does that make a lot of sense to you?
Well, it definitely, you know, makes sense. I'm just surprised because Tony Visconti is such a great producer and has done so many fantastic albums over the years.
Yeah.
To think that he is associated with this sort of musical disaster. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. I mean, these songs are just not good. I mean, I love this man. I have like multiple copies of every album he's ever put out that I can get my hands on. And I love his style of playing. But if Tony Visconti is responsible for some of these decisions, then the blame lies strictly in his lap, because some of these tones, Kevin, I mean, I'm warning you now. When you listen to this record, you're going to be surprised that this ain't no Arthur or, you know, Six Wives.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, so let's have a look and see if we can conjure a bit with some of the track names, the song names. Okay, so we've got four sides to get through, so we'll go fairly quickly through this. But again, hopefully it'll give us, me, an idea of what I'm looking for. Forward to, or maybe not. So the first one's called Pedra da Gouveia or something like that. Now I had to look that up. It's a monolithic mountain in the Tijuca forest in Rio de Janeiro. So again, we've got shades of Patrick Mraz here, haven't we? So looking forward to some Patrick Mraz style keyboard playing in that, perhaps. Then Frontline, can't really tell much from that. Thirdly, a typical Wakeman Bombay Duck. Number four, Animal Showdown, brackets, Yes, We Have No Bananas. Yeah.
The titles.
I know, even the titles really puts you off, doesn't it? Number five on that side one. So these are all really short pieces. There's nothing more than 4 minutes 11 on this first side. Big Ben, so that's the bell on the clock tower in London. So already there's a bizarre collection of different things. Side two, only 5 minutes 26 of Rhapsody in Blue, which was the Gershwin piece arranged by Tony Visconti himself. So they've obviously just cut out most of it, because I think it's about 12, 14 minutes long, that piece, when you play the whole thing. Then we have the Woolly Willy Tango. So the two songs, pieces at the side of, on the beginning of side two, wouldn't have been done if it had been up to Rick Wakeman himself. And then the Pulse, I can't imagine what Woolly Willy Tango is, just such a silly name. And the fourth piece, Swan Lager. Now, I don't know, is that something that you have in Canada, Swan Lager?
No, I don't think, not that I've ever come across, but I warn you about this, even though this is supposed to be Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake mixed in with, what does it say?
Grieg.
Piano Forte Concerto in A Minor.
Yeah, by Grieg.
This is his interpretation of this, mixed in with Jamaican reggae. Okay?
Okay. All right. Moving swiftly on then. It doesn't get any more sane on side three, I can tell you. March of the Gladiators. So that could be fun. Flasson or Flachon or something, de Neige, which is, I had to look up again, is snowflake, that means. And then The Flasher. Now, The Flasher is a tune from, what, British music hall tradition or something like that, you know? Or something like that. So yes, fascinating to know what that is. And then The Palais. No, not a clue. So let's just get through the rest. Side four, Stand By, all of these short pieces. Seahorses, Half Holiday, that's another one he said he wouldn't have done. Summertime, another George Gershwin tune, arranged by Rick Wakeman himself. And the fifth one on the last side, Credits.
Yes. Now, just if I can just jump in really quickly. In my opinion, sides three and four are much stronger than one and two. Seahorses is actually a pretty nice song. I'll give it that. Okay. And Summertime is probably the best of the covers that he's done on this album.
Okay. All right. So I was fascinated also to see the forces used, Rick Wakeman keyboards, likely vocals, it says on Wikipedia, and vocoder on Pedra da Gouveia, or have you pronounced that? Interesting. Bruce Lynch played the bass guitars. Frank Gibson Jr. played the drums and percussion. Nico Ramsden, the electric guitar. And Tony Visconti played some acoustic guitar and was also the engineer. So fascinating stuff. And it has one of those, I suppose, typical, slightly cheesy front covers, doesn't it, this one?
Yes, and the gatefold is not much better when you open it.
I'm afraid but I have not taken the opportunity to purchase myself a copy of this, and I'm just going to be listening to it via Spotify, I'm afraid.
I will send you photos, so not to leave you out of the joy of this album in full.
Okay. So remember, this is after Tormato. This is after the Paris sessions, which were disastrous in themselves. So it sounds like he was working on this actually before, during, and after the Paris sessions there, if he recorded this in 78, but it definitely came out after he officially left the band. So we're taking this as the first official thing that he produced after leaving Yes. So just to talk about the chart positions, as he said, in Norway, bizarrely, it reached number 15 in the charts. In the UK, only number 25, and in the US, well, 170. Does that really qualify to be in the charts? I suppose it does on the Billboard 200, but clearly it didn't really bother anyone apart from in Norway, it seems. So didn't really make the kind of splash that perhaps he was used to himself, with all those huge crowds attending concerts further back in his solo career. So what do you know about this A&M? So did this really signal the demise of A&M wanting anything to do with him, and he moved on to a different record company? What was the situation?
I think it was mutual, because remember, there was a time there, and I remember telling you that they had that, you know, emergency meeting they called Rick to, because that they were alarmed that his record at that time, and I don't remember if it was Arthur or if it was something else, but they were alarmed that it was only selling at 15 million copies at that time. So, you know, he got very annoyed with this sort of approach that was happening within the, you know, the higher ups management. So I think that for a fact that while they might have been, you know, getting a little flustered with him, I think that he definitely wanted out himself and wanted to maybe move on with some different, you know, backing.
Yeah. So do you know which company he went to next?
After this, I remember seeing that there was a lot of, I think it was Charisma, in fact.
Ah, right.
That was next. Right. Because I remember my 1984 vinyl that I got. I know that song Charisma. Uh-huh. And that wasn't too long after these records. I'm pretty sure it's Charisma. I know later on he ended up doing his own imprint called President Records, where Silent Nights and all these other albums are out on that. Right. But I'll make sure I have that fully researched by the time we do our next episode of this. But I'm pretty sure it's Charisma.
Well, that's all fascinating. And as usual, great stories and great fun with Rick Wakeman. I wonder if the music is going to be as great fun as all that.
You'll see.
Yeah, looking forward to that. So we'll be coming back to that. Do have a listen, if you possibly can, to Rhapsodies in the meantime yourself, and let us know what you think of that. Do you have a copy? Is it one of your favourites that you pull down off the shelf every so often and have a good listen to? So yes, please do write your comments about Rhapsodies on the show notes for this week. And we will be back talking about that very soon. But we've also got several people who want to come onto the show and talk about their new books. John Kirkman, that we've just spoken about, his dialogue books that we've got our hands on now. And also Dave Watkinson wants to come on and talk about his book, which is finally being released. I'm really looking forward to that. It'll be available through Burning Shed. But we'll say a lot more about that when we speak to him very soon indeed. But for the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
I've had all Yes Music podcast every week. I love to hear what Kevin says. I've had all Yes Music podcast every week. I love to hear what Kevin says.
So just before we go, here's the patron update. Yes Music podcast producers are Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, and Wayne Hall. And half of the Yes Music podcast patrons are Mark James Lang, Martin Kjellberg, Michael O'Connor, Miguel Falcao, Neil Caffrey, Paul Hales, Paul Tomei, Paul Wilson, Peter Herndon, Lobate Scarp, Rachel Hadaway, Mark Zarkol-Bags, Robert Naser, Scott Colombo, Scott Smith, Simon Barrow, Stephen Lamb, Steve Dill, Steve Perry, Steve Rode, Steve Scott, Stephen Raw, Terence Sadler, Tim Stannard, Todd Dudley, Tony Handley, Joseph Cottrell, Keith Hoisington, William Hayes, and Michael Handahan. Also, continued thanks, as always, to Robert and David. So, once again, thank you very much indeed to those patrons who are helping to keep the lights on at YMP Towers. If you'd like to join them in supporting the show financially and having access to lots of exclusive content and activities, head over to Patreon, patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast, or click the link on yesmusicpodcast.com. So that's just about all the time we have this week. Thanks so much for listening once again. Next week, I do hope we'll be back with an interview with David Watkinson. In the meantime, do follow the show on Instagram, on Twitter, and on Facebook. So until next week, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.